The following Dharma talk was given by Bear Gokhan Bonnebaker at Zen Mountain Monastery. Gokhan Osho is a Dharma holder and priest in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered freely. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
The Buddha's teachings are very simple. He said that his teaching could be understood simply as suffering and the cessation of suffering. It's acknowledging suffering, the experience of disease, disappointment. He said, yes, if that is in your experience, and if you look closely, it seems to pervade our experience. And he said there's something to be done about it. It can be transformed. We can free ourselves from suffering. When I first read about Buddhism, both parts of this, I felt like I had read in other places an acknowledgement of suffering, sort of description that matched my own, that I resonated with. But it was the first time I had really found someone say that there's something you can do. And not only that there's something that you can do, but there's a path. The Buddha taught a path. There are practices that have been found to work, things that you can do that work, that can lead. To less suffering, to transforming suffering. It's a kind of map, guide. And so the Buddha called this the Noble Eightfold Path, a path with eight limbs. And so this is pretty simple. We can understand that. We can understand these teachings. And then spend a lifetime practicing, truly understanding for ourselves. There are several talks that I am giving this summer, and I thought I would give a series of talks on the path, and particularly on the Eightfold Path. I will be sort of as I felt like that would be helpful for me. I learned from the process of writing talks. I hope it will be helpful for all of us. So the Eightfold Path is right understanding, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And I have always gotten a little bit stuck on this right. Is it saying right or wrong? Is it giving me rules that I'm supposed to follow? I think that's part of what I get kind of stuck on. I don't want to be told what to do, still. There are other translations, other ways to understand what's being pointed to. Appropriate, so appropriate action, appropriate intention. Correct, not so different than right. Complete, complete understanding, complete intention. Balanced, beneficial. And those, so some of those may be helpful. But they're also, the Buddha is saying, this is what should be done. If you want to follow this path, if you want to follow this liberative path. Thich Nhat Hanh says that the eight practices of the Eightfold Path nourish each other. They interpenetrate. We need each of the path factors. Working with the whole of ourselves, with each part of ourselves. It might be that at a particular time we focus on a certain aspect of the path, practice. In a moment, it might be that the teaching of one of the factors is what you need. But ultimately, as this teaching is laid out, we need them all, and as we mature into the way, they should all be functioning, all be maturing, all be present. And I think that this is kind of a significant point. We put an emphasis on meditation, on Zazen. And there's a reason for that. We need the access to our mind. We need to learn to see directly, to see below all of our thinking, see what's happening. But we need the whole of the path. Maybe a danger even of not taking up the whole of the path. And it also may be that there are aspects of the path that are just sort of feel more uncomfortable, inconvenient. We avoid. But it is an eightfold path. We need the whole of it in order to accomplish the way. One of our monastic vows is to accomplish the Buddha's way. This is the Buddha's way. I think to appreciate that there is a path, we don't have to, we don't have to make this up for ourselves. Should appreciate that. And also to appreciate that we're part of a tradition that began with the Buddha, with these original teachings. I find it helpful to go back to these original teachings, to remember the foundation. And we're part of the Zen tradition, which was Chan and China 1,500 years ago, started to sort of come together as a distinct tradition, as distinct school of practice. And so to be guided by the practices that have been passed down, the teachings and practices, they have evolved. Things changed in China, changed in Japan, changed here. Practicing here, we practice within a particular tradition, do things particular ways, emphasize particular practices. You know, there are times when we're sort of looking at things and I at least am like, but that's how Daido Roshi established this. And what is the wisdom in that? And there's evolution, seeing this doesn't work so well. May not be skillful. You see that in just studying the history when Buddhism came to China. It wasn't practical for the monks to beg for their living. They had to change. That was an important part of practice in India. It wouldn't work here. We wouldn't do so well. So some changing. What is helpful? What is skillful? And also sometimes seeing in the tradition, in the teachings, things that actually don't seem true. There are times in my study where I will find something that's like, that just doesn't seem true. Must be something that was sort of brought in from a cultural or societal or just that author's understanding, kind of personal understanding rather than wisdom. And I say all of this, you know, there are ways there in, you know, I've chosen this tradition. I think it's worth remembering we have chosen, right? And there are ways that I question. But for the most part, as I continue, I trust more and more that I can find my own way within this tradition, allowing myself to be guided, of adjusting myself to the tradition. And I think this is important, that we have to allow ourselves to be guided, to adjust ourselves rather than trying to adjust the tradition, what's been passed down. And all the way along to verify for ourselves, is it working? That's why we learn to trust. I have a relative who has been kind of important for me. She has not, in many ways in her life, she has not followed the sort of beaten path. She's been an artist and a seeker and I was speaking to her a while back, and she was sort of asking me about my life, and I hadn't talked to her and hadn't seen her in quite a while. And she was sharing some about her life, and I just, you know, some of what I said in response to what she was asking was just about the tradition. Sort of saying, yeah, part of what I'm realizing is like understanding the tradition for myself, understanding the teachings of the tradition that I'm part of for myself. But in talking to her, it made me appreciate she has chosen not to be part of her tradition. She's chosen to find her own way. And I guess I was hearing that maybe she hasn't quite found the way. The path is not linear. We hear the word path, and you know, I sort of picture like one of the stone paths that we have around here, one step after the other. I think we kind of want it to be linear. But it's not so much sequential. And yet there is progress, there is traveling the path. Downstairs, we have the 10 Oxarding pictures, kind of a different kind of depiction of the path, more showing progress, the potential for progress, the struggle, the not knowing, the looking, how do I do this, transforming into seeing more clearly, walking with more confidence, less struggle, less struggle. Less struggle. Bogen said, practice and realization are the same thing. How is that? We're practicing being a Buddha, practicing Buddha, manifesting Buddha, practicing manifesting Buddha. Do you remember Daidaroshi used to say, all the way to heaven is heaven itself. I didn't always really know what he was saying, but he really liked saying that. He said that with great gusto. The Eightfold Path is often divided into three sections. You can kind of hear this in the list. And so the section of what's usually called moral discipline, the right speech, right action, right livelihood, the concentration section, it's right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, and insight or wisdom, right understanding, right intention. You can hear in this list the three trainings, which is another sort of presentation of the path, the precepts, samadhi, concentration, meditation, and prajna, insight. And there's a kind of logic to this order, that the morality practices come first. In some traditions, you would first take the precepts, take up the precepts, practice the precepts for some time. Shugen Roshi talks about getting our own house in order, so that then we're kind of like settled enough in our life that we can take up meditation in a way that is, it's like we're ready. We're settled enough that then we can turn inwards, work with our mind. But in the sutras, in the Buddhist teaching, the path is almost always presented in the order that we're used to hearing it in, with the wisdom factors first, right view, right intention. And I thought it was kind of interesting, a little anecdote about that. The one time in the sutras where it is presented with the moral discipline first was a teaching by the nun Dhammadina. There are just a handful of teachings in the sutras which are not actually the Buddha speaking, right, but one of his disciples. And in this sutra, someone comes to Dhammadina, and it seems like maybe they're actually looking for the Buddha, but they find Dhammadina and ask their question, and Dhammadina gives this teaching, which includes the Eightfold Path. And the person who's come for the teaching is you know, she has met him and given him what he needed. But then at the very end of the sutra, he goes off and finds the Buddha and recounts what Dhammadina taught him. And the Buddha says, and it's not clear, you know, it's not clear, are you like testing it? And the Buddha says, exactly. I would have said it exactly that way. The wisdom factors come first because we need some understanding. We need some guidance. What do we do? How do we start? And so they come first, and then in a way they come last. They are what we are realizing. And so I wanted to look at these first two a little bit today. And so first was usually presented as right view, or sometimes right understanding. And I think those are both helpful translations. The Buddha said that right view is that which is most responsible for human happiness, and that wrong view is what is most responsible for human suffering. And so bringing attention to understanding, what is our understanding of our life? Of sort of like, how does this all work? This situation that we're in. And if we want to live a good life, to have ease and peace, then what should we do? How do we understand that? You can understand of the whole of the Buddhist teachings is kind of a diagnosis, an explanation. This is how it works. Your mind, that is. And that when we misunderstand, then we suffer, we struggle. It does not go well. We can try pretty hard at samsara, but it does not work very well. And when we understand, there's less struggle, because we act differently based on that understanding. And so I think an important part of this understanding is that there is something below our actions, motivating our actions, that we're acting out of. whether we're aware of that or not. And maybe often, most of the time, we're not. We kind of can't see. I was remembering many years ago when I was teaching high school way up in northern Vermont. One morning I came into school and there was this sort of like chatter. Overheard some of the students. One of the teachers had gotten a ticket for going over 100 miles an hour on their motorcycle on the way to school. And I think it was later in the day, sort of in the lunchroom with the other teachers, this teacher who was not embarrassed was, you know, maybe someone asked him, you know, what were you thinking? And he said, well, you know, that's what my parents used to ask me. And he was like, I wasn't thinking. That was sort of the point. But so what is the view, the understanding that underlies our actions? So he's saying that there is our view and conditions our actions. Leads to action, leads to creating karma. And so I could say this is why we emphasize meditation. We need to get access. We need to be able to see. How is this working? Can we see our own view? How do we see our own view? To see that it is a view, the way that we see the world and ourselves, the way that we understand kind of how things work, how we work. And so in developing right understanding is understood is basically understanding, seeing the way the Buddha did. And so understanding our life as the Four Noble Truths and understanding cause and effect. Karma, maybe just easier to simply cause and effect, which is closely related to the teaching, the guiding teaching of wholesome and unwholesome, what is skillful and what is not skillful, what leads to suffering and what leads to less suffering. And so, you know, understanding cause and effect, this too can seem simple. It's like, yeah, of course. We can see that, right? We do something and it has an effect. And it is very subtle. It's what makes all of this possible, makes practice possible. You know, in the description of the Buddha's realization, you know, it said that he could see all of karma, see his own karma, kind of in detail, and everyone's karma. There's a place in the sutras where Ananda, I think it is, comes to the Buddha and says, I think I understand karma. And he said, no, you do not understand karma. And basically says, only a Buddha can truly understand karma, truly understand cause and effect. See. What if we could truly understand, see the effects of our actions, our thoughts, our words? What would happen? What would we do? I have a feeling we can see more than we kind of want to see, more than we're willing to see. In the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness, he talks about mindfulness of mind, mindfulness of our own mind, and mindfulness of the minds of others. It's very interesting. And that's when I first encountered that, it was sort of seemed mysterious. Is he talking about like reading other people's minds? But pay attention. we really pay attention, we can know more than, we can know quite a bit about what's happening with someone else. And I was thinking about that with the, you know, the people in the world who have, whose actions have such an effect, are having such an effect on so many people. What if they could see that? What then? How do we see our view? How do we see the effect of our view, of our understanding? And so if we understand the teaching that if our view is misunderstanding, then that leads to suffering. There is some misunderstanding if we are creating suffering. And so to look there, there are particular places where we get tangled up around food and sex and self-doubt, shame, regrets, where we know, we see, there's something, I'm tangled up, there's something happening, I'm doing something. I'm suffering, I'm struggling here. And so to know, so that comes from somewhere in there, there is a kind of a misunderstanding. Look there. Because that's where there's transformation possible. Another understanding of right view is to have faith that there are people who have been able to transform their suffering. To have faith that realization is possible. Faith that there is accomplishment of the way. It's kind of an interesting way. It's like this, the original teachings can be kind of logical sometimes. So I'd like to hear the Four Noble Truths here from the point of view of faith, trust, and kind of a way to like make it more personal, make it more feelingful. And so the Buddha began with suffering. He kind of said, this is the essential, the fundamental, kind of the only spiritual question. Is suffering. He started there. In other Buddhist traditions, there have been other ways of expressing this sort of the fundamental, sort of the basic teachings. Right? You could begin with Buddha nature. You're okay. We begin there. Begin without understanding. Complete. Know that. Begin there. You could begin with interdependence. I was remembering Daido Roshi again. He used to talk about Indra's net quite a bit. We don't hear that anymore. Indra's net is a net of diamonds, I think, that all reflect each other. Each diamond reflects each other diamond. And represent how interdependent we are, how connected we are, all things. We could begin there. These other teachings, places to begin, not contradicting the original teaching. Right intention, which is also sometimes translated as right thought. So how are we guided as we practice the path? I think of our vows, the bodhisattva vows. Why do we chant those so often, remind ourselves so often? Remembering the purpose of our practice. Why are we doing this? In the original teachings, right intention is presented as the intention of renunciation, intention of goodwill, and the intention of harmlessness. And so the intention of renunciation, think of the four vows, desires are inexhaustible, a vow to put an end to them, a vow to lessen them, as Zenma Roshi said, a vow to study attachment and desire and how I create suffering. If grasping and aversion are at the root of our suffering, our dissatisfaction, then that's where our work is. Look there, study that. Is that true? How is that true? Find that in your own experience. I hear people say, you know, I know I'm not supposed to be attached. I know I'm not supposed to have desires. Teachings are not saying that desires are bad. There are good desires, skillful desires. But let there be a question. Let this be a place of study. And the teachings say, when we see for ourselves, when we understand for ourselves, then naturally our attachments will loosen, desires will lessen. And in this study, our concern has to be finding, seeing what is true, how things actually are, rather than with our comfort. Right, we say a lot, it's okay to be uncomfortable. Jigen Roshi talks about how there has to be some rigor to practice, to training. Right, when we do sesshin, there's a reason that the schedule is tight. We get up early. It's helping us to see. The intentions of goodwill and of harmlessness are about developing loving kindness, so the desires for others to be happy, and developing compassion, which is wanting others to be free of suffering. Let's go together, I think. So again, to hear our vows, we're going to chant them in a few minutes. Sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them. To hear in there, to make part of that for yourself, wanting others to be happy, to be free of suffering. And also in this teaching of right intention, right thought, to look for ourselves. What happens when we open to include in our concern for others? There isn't this working with anger and aversion, with ill will. Also to let there be a question here, a place of study. What does it do for us? It's right intention is sometimes translated as a right thought. And their teachings here, there's a sutra in which the Buddha talks about realizing in his training, seeing in his training in that there were two categories of thought that he saw in his mind, thoughts that were of ill will, of desire, and that led to suffering. And thoughts that were more of compassion. I don't know if you can have a thought of renunciation. But in the sutra, so he kind of says there are good thoughts and there are bad thoughts. And that seeing this in his mind, he said, well, so let me try removing the bad thoughts and bringing in good thoughts. And when I read this, I'm like, really? That's like not what we teach. He talks about driving a peg, using one peg, the peg of a good thought, to drive out the peg of a bad thought. So it's quite forceful too. And there are places in the sutras where where the Buddha speaks in ways that are quite forceful, almost violent. And it's like, what is that? Sholin yesterday was talking about the Faith Mind poem and working, sort of using that. How do we work with thoughts? And just don't pick and choose. Don't have aversion. Don't push it away. And don't grasp it. Allow space. Allow it to pass away. How do these practices go together? I think I would say that they both can be helpful practices. Be gentle. Be gentle. But there is, I think, in my last talk, I talked about a little bit about seeing in myself sort of complaining mind and feeling I'm ready to let that go. And I've been paying attention to that. So when I see a complaining mind, how do I meet that? And looking at that, how do I loosen that? How do I let that pass? How do I not give that energy? Because I know that's not helpful for anyone. The way I just like I don't want that. I don't want to be cultivating that. And so it's not pushing it away. That's not helpful. That's not skillful. That doesn't really work. But in a way, there is. Let me cultivate something else. Let me cultivate something else. Acknowledging the power, the influence of our thoughts. It matters how we use our mind. It matters. It does something. I know I've shared this before when I was, my years of really struggling with negative thoughts directed towards myself. Dada Roshi at one point, I think he just was like, I don't know what to say to this guy. And he was like, well, so why don't you try substituting a good thought for a bad thought? And I was like, I didn't want to do that. It's like, well, that's just substituting one false just created thought for another just created thing. But you know, I thought about this and I give people this instruction, right? We can say it's something that is true. What about saying to myself, I am perfect and complete. I am whole. That is true. Right? We could substitute a true thought. It's still just a thought, but thoughts have an effect. Find a true thought. Another sort of simple way that the path is explained is do good, don't do harm, and tend to your mind, cultivate your mind. You know, it can kind of seem, when I look out, at the internet, I was going to say the world, it can kind of seem that, you know, simply trying to live a good life, to do good, to not do harm, is like going against the stream is kind of radical. It's not what is held up. It's like, how did that happen? Simply to live a good life. How is that not what we're all striving to do? And I've been thinking a lot about, and in particular meeting some of you this weekend. But it feels like kind of an underlying question. What should I be doing? What should we be doing now? What should we be doing? And I don't know. There's a story in the Sutras of the Buddha. There was a war starting, I think, between his own people. And I think the story is that the first time he was able to go talk to them and convince them not to fight. And the second time he was not able to convince them. And he went and he sat on the sidelines as his kinspeople killed each other. For some time, that story kind of haunted me. I was like, what does that mean? What is the teaching in that story? What was he doing? What was he doing? What did he do anything? And I wasn't going to talk about this, but I thought of it this morning, just sort of as I took my seat here. What should we be doing? Last week, Shoen said, let us take back our awareness. A while ago, Shun and Roshi said, let's reclaim our minds. This weekend I was saying, return to yourself. May we return to ourselves and be in touch with what we know is true, not lose touch with ourselves. We should not turn away. And we can practice, make our lives be to do good as we can, to not cause harm as much as possible, to be aware, and to work with our mind, turn to our mind, cultivate our mind. That we can do.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.